I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. On Saturday, Judge Stephen O'Neill declared a mistrial after the jurors in the sexual assault trial of Bill Cosby were deadlocked, having deliberated for 5 days. The judge explained that a mistrial was not a victory or a vindication, merely the justice system at work. The Montgomery County District Attorney Kevin Steele said he would retry the case. Joining us are Bobby Allen and Laura Benshoff, who covered the trial for WHYY's Newsworks. And nice to have you both with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. The judge took great pains to protect the identities of the juror. This really began, Bobby, in the very beginning. Why was he so protective? Do you know?
So they were under a sequester. They were sequestered, which means that they couldn't talk to any members of the media. They could barely talk to their family. And that was to keep the integrity of the process. They didn't want any outside influence. So throughout the entire two-week trial, nobody talked to them. They went on a bus. They went to the hotel. They came back. And even after the trial, they had police escorts to their bus when they went back to Pittsburgh because they were drawn from Pittsburgh. And still, one of the big questions as we look at this case now is what was going on in that deliberation room? What were they talking about? And no journalist so far has been able to track any juror down who was in that deliberation room. So it remains a very active question.
And it seems, Laura, the judge is being very protective of this jury, even after this non-verdict was rendered.
He is. He was supposed to release the names immediately following, you know, a verdict. Well, we didn't get a verdict. And now he's kind of punted on that. And the prosecutors are saying, hey, look, if media descends upon these 12 people, we're worried that will taint the future jury pool. Should we want to retry this? They're just kind of worried that this somehow will influence future jurors in a way that could negatively impact their case. So they're still keeping them very clamped down at this point.
We should add that WHYY is party to a number of other news outlets that, that wants access to these names.
Exactly.
You want to add to that, Bobby?
Yeah. So WHYY, Philadelphia Inquirer, the Philadelphia Daily News, and a number of other news organizations have filed a motion to ask the judge to release these names. There's a real First Amendment argument to be made that now they are private citizens. They are no longer sequestered. They are, you know, folks from Allegheny County who were tasked with deciding Bill Cosby's fate, and they became hopelessly deadlocked. And now the case is in limbo. Why did that happen? I think the public really wants to know what went on in that jury room and, you know, what those conversations were like. And we can't do it unless we have their identities. So stand by with that. Maybe we'll get their names. And if we do, you'll be hearing back from us.
Absolutely. Laura, describe what it was like, though, in the courtroom itself. We were talking before going on the air. There was a kind of a screen in front of the jurors, but it didn't completely block the sight line.
That's right. So it's a historic courtroom. It's very grand. But to make it sort of retrofitted for modern technology and how to actually display evidence to the jury, they put up this enormous, like 6 foot wide smart board that almost completely obscured the jury from our sight. So, you know, reporters were kind of all craning to the right to try to lean and see as many jurors as we could. And I could see the three on the end really well. And you're just trying to pick up on body language and cues, who's looking at whom when certain evidence is being presented or when certain questions are being asked. But it was really hard to parse, you know, who are the holdouts?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And that made
even looking at things like body language. Probably.
Yeah,
exactly. That made covering the trial really difficult because, I mean, when you cover trials, you want to look at what's working, what's not. Are people crying? Are they gasping? Are they falling asleep? Are the attorneys being persuasive? And when we look over at the jury box during the trial, you saw mostly this giant white screen. So in the coverage, you would maybe get the reaction of a juror or two, the ones we could see kind of beyond the screen. But for the most part, that was a big gap in the coverage.
Describe Judge Stephen O'Neill, Laura. How did he maintain control? You said folksy, Bobby.
Folksy and very very methodical. You could tell that, you know, he really wanted to bulletproof this case. He, you know, every day spent a long time warning the juries not to, you know, bring any bias into the case, not to read any news about it. He heard every pretrial motion, you know, from talking to other people who cover criminal courts, you know, morning, noon, and night. They're saying this case was given more consideration by the judge than you would generally get. You know, motions went on forever. Certain types of hearings that wouldn't have even been entertained, he did entertain because he really wanted to show that he was doing his due diligence throughout. And he was pretty stern. I mean, there was a lot of clamp down on communication in the courtroom. Like we said, clamp down on who the jurors could even see or talk to. So he really he went out of his way to be very much the authority in the courtroom.
Why did you call him Folksy Bobby?
Oh, just because when he came in and out of the courtroom after he took off his robe, you could hear him whistling. One of the big things about Stephen O'Neill when you talk to court staff and reporters who go there every day is he's a big whistler. And that just kind of speaks to just he has this kind of folksy way about him. I mean, he's very serious. He's a very smart judge. I talked to people on both sides, both the prosecution and the defense, and they both said he has a great reputation. Both sides agree that he was really fair in this trial. And he did have a bit of a sense of humor. I mean, he, like Laura said, he was very stern and he was very grave about maintaining the integrity of the process and making sure the jurors were not tainted by outside influence. But he did hear both sides when they had complaints. And it's as an impartial observer, I thought he was fair.
This case, and there have been a number of women who have accused Bill Cosby of some degree of sexual assault. Why this one particular case? And I ask that because so many people talked to me this weekend who had been following it, but they still did not understand why just Andrea Constand. Do you want to take that, Laura?
Yeah, it is very confusing. The short answer is more than 50 women have come forward, but some of their cases and their accusations date back to the 1960s, and in general, the statute of limitations prevented them from ever coming forward, and a lot of them didn't go to law enforcement at the time. You know, Andrea Constand, the alleged assault happened in 2004. She did go to the law enforcement in 2005. She initiated an investigation then. So the pieces were in place for her to actually come forward. And in many ways, she was symbolic of all those other accusers. Mm-hmm. I think people do kind of collapse it all in their minds. But really, this case was about one accuser.
And how was she on the stand, Bobby?
On the stand, she was headstrong, confident, pretty much unflappable. I mean, people thought she was going to be the marquee event of this trial. Everyone was really anticipating it. But she got up on the stand, and it was mostly yes or no answers. Huh. When she was pushed about inconsistencies that she gave to police, when she was pushed about other things that were maybe contradictory in hindsight, she just said, I didn't remember at the time. I mean, but I think the one thing that really stood out to me was just how strong she was. I mean, she had moments where that when she was recounting the 2004 incident in question that were really emotionally hard, and she broke down a little bit. But I mean, it wasn't this huge, dramatic, tearful sort of episode. Like, she was very, very confident and very tough throughout.
And Bill Cosby did not testify. I mean, Laura, that was indicated even before that seems even before the trial began.
Yeah, he said something to that effect on the Smirconish show here locally a couple of weeks before the trial, and then his spokesman dangled it in front of us. You know, he dangled it right before the defense mounted their case, saying, "Oh, he might," but he didn't, and there was no need for him to in some cases because he'd already described the events in a civil case, and they were able to hear all those words. The jury was able to hear from him that way.
And the one thing I was going to add to that as we look forward to this new trial, I mean, both sides have an idea of what the strategy is going to be. I mean, the defense now knows all of the prosecution's evidence, but had the defense put Cosby on the stand, the prosecution would have another bit of sworn testimony to try to rip apart and to put back in his face. Because Cosby didn't testify, they don't have that. They just have his prior statements in a deposition from 10 years ago, a recorded statement that he made with Gianna Constand, the accuser's mom. So I bet the defense team is pretty relieved that they didn't put the defendant on the stand.
Well, let me play Andrew Wyatt. He a Cosby spokesman, and he was very present speaking to the press and probably to the public. And this is him speaking right after the verdict.
Mr. Cosby, power is back. It's back. It has been restored. The jurors, they use their power to speak. And Mrs. Cosby, power is back. So the legacy didn't go anywhere. It has been restored. And for all those attorneys who conspired like Gloria Allred, tell them to go back to law school and take another class.
That gives us a flavor, Laura and Bobby, about what it was like outside the courtroom.
Yeah, he was definitely trying to influence the court of public opinion throughout the case. Andrew Wyatt made several statements. There was a media podium set up outside, and he would get out there and he would impugn the judge, say the judge was biased and was collaborating with the prosecutors. He would call upon Cosby's supporters, which we honestly didn't see too many of during the trial. Cosby's family was largely absent, except for Camille one day, and a few people he appeared with in movies, a few decades ago showed up, but his family didn't come. Not a lot of high-profile people were there. But still, Andrew was out there in front of the cameras every day saying this process is biased. You know, my boss's legacy will be restored. And yep, That's their line.
Let me just quote some of the things that Mrs. Cosby said. She talked about the heinous, ambitious district attorney, the overtly arrogant. The district attorney, the judge, was overtly arrogant, called the accusers totally unethical. It seems like, Bobby, she really unloaded.
She really did. And when Kevin Steele, the DA from Montgomery County, was asked about these statements from Camille Cosby, he wouldn't entertain them at all. He wouldn't respond. But the whole Cosby team really capitalized, arguably exploited the absence of other images and quotes, because in Pennsylvania you can't record in courtrooms, so the network televisions needed shots of something. So often every day after court, who were those shots of but Andrew Wyatt, Cosby's spokesman, who would often say things that would contradict what Cosby's own legal team was saying. Yeah. So it presented a bit of a quandary.
You want to add something, Laura?
I was going to say Wyatt and Gloria Allred became the de facto spokespeople in this case.
Let me play another clip. And this is the Montgomery County District Attorney Kevin Steele. And he's speaking to reporters after the verdict. Of course, the verdict coming down on Saturday.
She's entitled to a verdict in this case. And the citizens of Montgomery County, where this crime occurred, are entitled to a verdict in this case, and we will push forward to try to get that done and get justice done.
What's the timeline, Bobby, do you know, for the next trial?
Yeah, so Judge O'Neill, who's presiding over this case, said as soon as 4 months from now, the new trial date would be set. We're going to save a lot of time because all of the pre-trial disputes that both sides have are now behind us. So there is a good chance we'll have a date set within 4 months. As everything goes in the criminal justice system, there could be and likely will be delay, but we could see Cosby re-entering the courtroom and a new trial starting pretty soon.
Laura, I'm sure you watched Bill Cosby during this trial. What did you see? How did he respond to testimony and arguments back and forth and the judge himself?
It's a good question. I mean, he was largely impassive for much of the testimony, but when he really agreed with something, you'd see him nodding his head, or when Andrea Constand was testifying, he shook his head no. Outside the courtroom, he kind of capered around and tried to maintain some of his old comedian-esque, you know, he's a funny man. He tried to maintain some of that. But in the courtroom, you know, they were long days. He had a handler who was carrying his pillow for him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, into the courthouse
a
every day.
To sit
a
on?
Pillow
to
No, for him to put his head on during breaks.
Wow.
So, I mean, he's a 79-year-old man, and there were times when they seemed to be, you know, that seemed to be more evident than other times because they were very, very long days.
Almost out of time here. Yeah. What was it like, or what is it like to cover this trial? It's not over. I mean, the trial's over, but the story continues.
It was a media bonanza. I've never covered anything that has been under this much scrutiny. It was this exciting and fast-moving. I think the sense of finality, at least the short-term finality, it was a bit of a relief for everyone covering it, but knowing that we might have to do this all over again 4 months from now, that's a challenging thought to have. But it's probably even more challenging for the accuser, Andrea Constand, and her family, who took the stand and endured, you know, very intense and excruciating cross-examination. They're going to have to do that again.
How about for you, Laura?
Yeah, I've never covered anything quite this large. People are saying it's the biggest case since the OJ case. Obviously, the media played a very different role in this case. You know, we were really the eyes and ears because there was no recording in the courtroom. So in some ways, you feel even like you have to make your coverage that much more cinematic. So it was very exciting.
You both did a great job. And thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, Laura Benshoff and Bobby Allen, talking about covering the trial of Bill Cosby for WHYY's Newsworks. Thanks very much.
Marty. Thank you, Marty.
And we got two guests waiting in the wings talking about whether Philadelphia is good and open for business. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, anyone can see that Philadelphia has been enjoying a revival with a thriving center city, university city, and cranes and construction projects in the surrounding neighborhoods. And while it hemorrhaged population in the last half of the last century, the city has been growing in recent years. And while these signs of life are a welcome change, job growth in Philadelphia has been lackluster compared to other big cities. Now, some blame the wage tax tax or the soda tax, too many regulations, the high rate of poverty, and the lack of a skilled workforce. Today on Radio Times, we want to talk about the ways that Philadelphia is and isn't a good place to do business and what to do about it. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Michael Nutter, former mayor of Philadelphia. He's currently president of Michael Nutter LLC. That's a public policy advisory firm. He's a CNN political commentator, and he teaches at Columbia University. And Mayor Nutter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Always a pleasure.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Josh Seven, acting executive director of the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia. And Josh, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And I do want to open up the phone line because I think there'll be a lot of interest, and I want to hear what our listeners have to say. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499, especially if you do business or you have a business in Philadelphia. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Josh Seven, I do want to begin with you, even though I'll get to you, Mayor Nutter, in just a moment or two, only because I read some pieces from the Economy League about some of the concerns that you and others have about Philadelphia as a place to do business. What do you see as the biggest, I guess, sticking point?
Well, I would start on the positive side. I think there's really been a huge amount of momentum in assets, skilled workforce, as you mentioned, a vibrant downtown, which has stretched across the river from traditional center city to University City. I think part of the current conversation centers around a set of ordinances which have either passed or been in consideration in city council, which some in the business community are portraying as not necessarily being business friendly, whether this is around paid sick leave, disclosure of previous salaries, ban the box legislation. Some of these are new policies which you're seeing in major cities all across the country. So part of this is, I think, a natural adjustment. Some other ones, we may be out front a bit more. And the more we're out front in one of these policies, the more you can expect the local business community to be vocal. But some of the prior, I think, sticking points around taxes, the city has actually become more and more competitive. There, of course, is still the issue of a very large wage tax.
A wage tax, right. Something that I've been talking about for 30 years on this show, Michael Nutter, and I'm sure as a member of city council and as mayor as well, in many ways the wage tax brings in money that the city needs to pay for services. How much do you think it prevents business opportunity?
Well, first, I mean, much like Josh, I think the city is heavily dependent, certainly on the wage tax. But as you mentioned, you've been talking about it for 30 years. And when I was last in office, it was at a 30-year low. And continues gradually to go down. And I'm sure folks would like it to go even more. What I would always say to people is, you know, I'd love to lower it more. I just have to run the government in the meantime. You know, we need to make a continued shift away from a very heavy dependency on the wage tax and on people. And as I know other public policy experts talk about, you know, basically kind of taxing things that can't move around.
People like have real estate, right?
Yes, specifically. So people have the ability to move around. And because of, you know, road networks, transportation networks, you know, SEPTA and a variety of other ways to get around the city and the region, you know, you can unfortunately still live close to Philadelphia, benefit from all that Philadelphia has to offer, but not necessarily have your business in Philadelphia. And that continues to be a challenge for us, but things have certainly improved over the last 30 years.
Well, let me go back to you, Josh. I'm picking up on what the mayor said about a commercial real estate tax. This is something that you have written about as a way to move from the dependency on the wage tax into something that would bring in revenue but would be better for business, I guess.
Yes. So as Mayor Nutter said, the big trick is what's the policy move to significantly reduce the wage tax when you're so reliant upon it? And a proposal has been on the table and in Harrisburg for a couple of years now that would propose to raise the levy on commercial properties as a way to substantially reduce the wage tax at the same time. If you will, a net neutral policy shift. And would achieve
bringing the same amount of money.
Exactly, at least from the start. The interesting thing about this proposal, it has come from major leaders in the local business and real estate community who are saying, yes, we think for the long run health of our businesses and most importantly for the city, we need to raise this levy. Because the rest of the country, this is what it looks like, a relatively higher property tax than Philadelphia has, and a wage tax more along the lines of 1% than 3%, which changes dynamics.
Or some don't really have one at all.
Right. A wage tax at all.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Is that you're no longer mayor, obviously, but is that something, is what Josh talking about, is that a direction you think Philadelphia should go in?
Well, as I said.
And I should say that the Chamber of Commerce is not crazy about this idea, as I understand.
Which was a little surprising.
Well, okay. It's a little interesting because, as Josh said, I mean, it's mainly business people who have come up with this proposal. I mean, this has been around for some time. It was under discussion when I was mayor. But it also does require legislative action by the General Assembly. And so in the meantime, you know, we kind of live in the present while we think about and plan for the future. So, I mean, it was not something that was realistic for me during my time. But I think it is beyond the talking stage. Mm-hmm. Anytime you touch the tax code, I mean, there's always risk. You go into legislative process, there's always risk. But I think it is one of the major barriers. Taxes is not the only challenge that the city faces, but it is a major barrier. It has a risk component to it. But I think we're now at a point, having gotten through the recession, the city, I mean, I travel more nationally now. I mean, the view about Philadelphia has significantly changed across the country and around the world. And this may be, you know, kind of one of those true pivotal moments for taking that kind of chance. And I understand, you know, the chamber represents a lot of different people. And so when you have a change in tax policy, often, you know, a variety of groups will benefit. Someone may be affected. If you represent everyone, you know, you got to be willing to take some of that grief that goes with it. But I think we're at a critical moment right now.
Well, and Philadelphia gets a lot of good press about a great place to visit and great
live,
restaurants
work,
and all of that.
Yeah.
And yet, I believe this came from you, Josh, the slowest growing of the largest cities when it comes to job creation.
Yeah. So
what does that tell us?
Well, I think we're in the midst of a really important paradox, because these tremendous assets and momentum are met with the reality of, when you look back 3, 5, 10 years, the city and the region are consistently have been 10th out of 10. So that, I think, is the real crux. And I think the big economic development question is, how can Philadelphia get on that higher growth trajectory like other mature cities? It's not going to be like a Las Vegas, but to be more like a Boston or a Chicago.
So what does Boston do? I mean, what does Boston have that Philly doesn't have? Do you know,
well,
Michael Munger?
I think there are a few things. And, you know, Boston is a wonderful city. There are a lot of
Agreed.
Great cities in America.
Agreed.
But speaking, you know, certainly for myself, I don't want to be like anywhere else. Because I think what I really want is for folks saying, we want to be like Philadelphia. We have a lot to offer. But I think the number one challenge that this great city and the region face is the issue of poverty. Unfortunately, Philadelphia has the highest poverty rate of the top 10 largest cities in the United States of America. We've been over 20% with a poverty rate for the last 30-plus years. So it is ingrained.
In spite of all the good intentions,
absolutely, right? So we have a workforce that or we have citizens who are not benefiting from all the good things that have happened, from the productivity, from the cranes in the sky, the buildings being built, the economic development, and the view of the world about this great city. There are still many Philadelphians, unfortunately, who are not participating in that economy. We have reentry folks, people coming out of incarceration, the literacy levels in our city. And so, again, there have been improvements across all of those areas. This is no criticism. It's just a statement of the facts that we could be so much more by making improvements in those areas.
Josh, you wrote a really interesting thing, which is, yes, Philadelphia has, as the mayor said, has a high rate of poverty, certainly the highest among the top 10 big cities, but we don't have enough wealthy people, sort of like the Silicon Valley type, you know, millionaires and billionaires.
Yeah, I think the important point at this moment is whether you are, if you are focused on the poverty issue as critical as it is for this region, you have to be part of this growth conversation, because the only way we are going to have the resources for the kinds of investments in human capital, infrastructure, and the like that will, I think, change the game on poverty it has to be through growth. So I think this has to do with a sustained vision on what are the key drivers for that growth. And so some of the cities that I think are maybe a leg or two ahead of us in the race, they're focusing on entrepreneurship over business attraction. They're focusing on exporting what they produce and the services that they provide. Mm-hmm. They're focusing on their innovation economy. We've got some real great starting points in each of those areas. The question is right now, can we focus our game in those key driver areas to get us on that higher growth trajectory?
Is it too hard to start a business in Philadelphia, Michael Netter?
No. I mean, I don't think so. I started one recently. I filled out the paperwork.
Have the name you have, nonetheless. Yeah, right.
I filled out the paperwork like everybody else, sent it in. You know, something came back. You get your BERT. We took away the cost for the commercial business license. I've now been on both sides of this to some extent, or maybe there's three sides: city council, mayor, and now private citizen.
Right.
The net profits tax, the BERT, I think for many business people, is probably still a confusing array of taxes, and then of course wage tax and everything else that we pay. So, we've had a variety of tax commissions. We've reduced the number of taxes that we have, but there's probably still more work to be done in that regard. I think the larger issue is, Josh made reference to the entrepreneurial community. Yeah. You look at a scan of the assets that the city has. Still, education and medicine, big drivers of this economy. But sustainability, life sciences, pharmaceuticals, research, all of those areas. How do we commercialize much of the research that takes place in Philadelphia? How are we supporting those young or young at heart folks who have ideas and want to start a business here in the city and the access to capital? You've got the big names, first round capital and Josh and the team out there. We need more of those capital opportunities for folks here in Philadelphia. But again, not everyone wants to be an entrepreneur. So how do you, again, drive a business environment that says, if you have administrative skills, if you have technical skills, you can get a job here in Philadelphia? And I think those are, again, a lot of areas that, continued focus will pay off for us.
And that's Michael Netter, former mayor of Philadelphia. He's currently the president of Michael Netter LLC. And he joins us along with Josh Seven, acting executive director of the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia. And we're talking about the ways to improve Philadelphia as a good place to do business. And we want to hear from you. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Looking for people that have a business or are thinking about a business in the city. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Josh, the mayor mentioned the net profits tax. I mean, we could do a whole wonky hour about all the various taxes.
Please don't.
I hear the audience saying the exact same thing.
I'll restrain myself.
Yes, exactly. But nonetheless, I mean, obviously cities need tax money to pay for services.
Sure.
But are we taxing the wrong thing? I mean, this probably gets back to the wage tax.
Well, there's no doubt. This goes to Econ 101, Urban Econ 101. Try to minimize taxing things that are highly mobile, because then they just may walk up and off and leave. And at some level, when you see all that Philadelphia is going for it, and you see us 10th out of 10th, which really is a bit of a conundrum, you still have to ask, how much is the wage tax still this decades-long self-inflicted wound? I'll say on the other side, broader trends in business development, you hear less talk about the cost and tax side, and you hear more talk about other fundamentals.
Like,
businesses need a skilled workforce. They need the reliable infrastructure to get that workforce to and from work and to move their goods. On those counts, even with high poverty levels, we're a large region. We have a substantial, enviable skilled workforce. So in some ways,
what's the disconnect then? If they exist and people want to hire them, what's the disconnect?
I think part of this is the economy is changing, continues to change and restructure at such a rapid rate. The question is, what are the real strong growth areas where we can really make our mark? we've always talked about eds and meds and life sciences. You look at what's going on in the university city section of the city and in other medical centers. What's going on now around cellular gene therapy in Philadelphia and these institutions, changing the world. And the question is, how can we capitalize more upon that? But even, you know, you look at some legacy industries like pharmaceuticals in the city and beyond. The business model is changing. So it's a highly competitive environment at all times. And there's this deep know thyself imperative on how can we best compete with our existing industry. So it's a fight.
And so many roads lead to education, Michael Nutter. And I mean, that's
no
really the
key. No question about
it.
I'm not sure what the recent numbers are, but you know, they probably haven't changed that much. There were, you know, at least in 2015, I think an estimated 30,000 positions available in varying levels of technology for which you did not need, do not need, a four-year bachelor's degree. You might need a one-year or possibly a two-year certificate. The use of and access to community college certainly a gateway into education for one of those certificates or a two-year opportunity, lower cost, and then finish your last 2 years at maybe a Temple or somewhere like that. They have a partnership. So part of this is, as Josh said, a rapidly changing economy. I mean, when you think about Philadelphia, a grand old industrial Northeast city, which the flip side of that, of course, is it's a grand old industrial Northeast city, right? We made Baldwin locomotives and Stetson hats and everything in between, a great manufacturing city. Well, actually, manufacturing is still a big industry in Philadelphia. It's just different. And so how do we get the word out? If you talk, what was that, molecular gene therapy? Or
cellular gene therapy.
Right, which I'm not qualified for.
But making
sure that other folks understand, even if you're not a scientist, right? Again, someone has to do back office operations. Someone has to answer the phone. Someone has to clean a place, landscaping, and a variety of other services. Those are jobs. And how do we get that word out that there is a job opportunity for you? What are we doing with, you know, we have a workforce development organization, Philadelphia Works. We always have to make sure that we're training for jobs for the future, working with the business community, understanding what their needs are 5 and 10 years down the road, not, you know, for jobs that we're starting to dissipate or go away 5 years ago. And so, lower cost of living.
Right.
Generally, a lower cost of operation. I mean, when you put it all in together, then New York or D.C.
Exactly. I want to pick up on that. That's Michael Nutter, former mayor of Philadelphia, and he's currently a CNN political commentator. He's been teaching at Columbia University, president of Michael Nutter, LLC. Josh Seven is with us as well, acting executive director of the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia, talking about how to make Philadelphia more business-friendly. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Michael Nutter and Josh Seven about whether Philadelphia is good for business or how it can be more business friendly. And of course, like any city, there's always this delicate balancing act, meeting the needs of citizens, the needs of companies that call a place home. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Josh, as Michael Nutter was talking about Philadelphia, this, you know, an old industrial city, but so was Boston. I mean, so was, in many ways, New York City. I was just in Brooklyn, and you live in a shoebox, and you pay just a gazillion dollars, but people seem to want to do that. So what do these other cities have, or what are they doing that seems to feel more vibrant, more attractive, people willing to sacrifice a lot to live in a very expensive city like New York?
I don't think the difference is around vibrancy. The story on Philadelphia, anybody who brings somebody who has a decade-plus view of the city into Philadelphia for a weekend, they end up asking about house and rental prices because they say, look at this place.
Right.
The question, I think, really often is on the economy and people's understanding of the range of opportunities. And a certain amount of it is perception. A certain amount of it is updating perceptions. Mayor Nutter talked about IT openings. The Economy League just took a deep look at our region's IT workforce, 100,000 jobs in IT professions. 25% of net job growth in our region has been in these IT jobs. So it's a major part. But you've got a lot of people who think there's not a place for me in that economy. Well, they don't recognize if
why?
You...
Why don't they know that?
Well, I think there are some broader myths or misunderstandings out there that people think IT is just about coding and they don't know. There are help desk jobs, which if you are a people person and you're good at customer service, you can get into help desk where there's great demand. If you can get into help desk, you're potentially tracked to work on cybersecurity. Okay, now you're talking a track where there's huge demand and the jobs pay very, very well. So there's so much rapid change in the IT space. Everybody knows who's in that. Whatever programming language is used today is laughable 5 years from now. So at some level, it's a very fast-moving set of industries and occupations. So we're not alone in kind of our residents maybe not being up to speed, but we've got a great opportunity to bring them into that opportunity because it represents such a big part of our region's recent growth.
Marty, I'm going to go back, though.
No, go ahead.
And the issue of education and literacy is critical. When you have 400,000 to 500,000 Philadelphians out of a population of 1.5 million and growing who have low literacy skills, that unfortunately will negatively impact their opportunities, their life outcomes, their ability to move themselves or and their families out of deep poverty or a poverty level. You can't take the GED on paper anymore. It's only on a computer.
Right.
Most job opportunities you are only going to find on a computer. And so again, access to information. Do you have a computer or a laptop or a tablet in your house? Do you have internet access? I mean, all of these issues are major challenges. We have, I think, an estimated 300,000 people in the city who have a previous criminal record. Yes, we have taken some steps, and I know Jess mentioned some.
Ban
the box. In my last year in office, major changes to hiring policies or what you can ask, what you can't ask. You can't ask for a criminal background investigation until you've made a conditional job offer for folks and businesses across the city. We changed the city's own hiring process because I think government should always lead the way and be in the vanguard. So, I mean, these are real life challenges that people have. And if you don't have access to the information, you don't know about the opportunities that were mentioned, the rapidly changing economy. When you are struggling on the edge, you know, you are not in a mood for a dissertation on, you know, the macroeconomic implications of, you know, worldwide whatever, right? It's how do I get a job today to feed my family, to feed myself and my kids.
Well, and there are all these competing needs, obviously. But to you, Josh, and you mentioned this earlier, and the mayor just mentioned, you know, the ban the box, the mandatory sick leave, the wage equity ordinance. From a business perspective, is that seen as burdensome, onerous, unfair, a reason not to set up shop in Philadelphia?
So I think in each of those areas, you heard from some area businesses who raised such concerns. And just last week, as there has been a kind of ongoing legal challenges around the recently passed salary disclosure legislation, a handful of 10 or 15 businesses came out and spoke specifically about why implementing this would really pose an extra challenge for them. Look, at some level, you expect this when any new regulation or tax, so you have to kind of sort through the noise a bit, right? There really is a question. You have to look at each policy and say, is this really disadvantaging the city overall, like a wage tax, versus something that doesn't? And only time really can tell on that. But I think it's important to recognize when you hear some voices on these, it's not representative by far of the entire business community.
Oh, interesting.
Think of the volume around the sweetened beverage tax. That's a particular lobby, much of which dollars are coming from outside of this region. And a set of businesses, not all businesses. So you need to look at each proposal.
I knew we were going to get to the soda tax. I knew you tried to pass that as mayor, Mayor Kenney was able to get it passed.
Pushed it forward a couple times.
Right.
And again, you know, 6 years later, in a different environment, with other challenges, more information that people had, the campaign that our health department in conjunction with the CDC put on about the impact of sugar-sweetened beverages on obese and overweight conditions, especially for our children, but also adults. And over time, literally 6 years later, the bill passed.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened with clean indoor air. which, you know, I did as a city council person. Proposed it in 2000, didn't pass until 2006. So often Philadelphia is in the lead, in the vanguard, or, you know, sometimes we might be in the latter stages of things. So what business wants, what they like, is certainty of process. And so a lot of this is about change. But again, cities, and ours in particular, have so much more to offer. I mean, these are day-to-day skirmishes about public policy. Taxes, workforce, access to capital. I mean, these issues are much longer term, much more challenging, but will give us the greater payoff beyond all of this other stuff, which often is really just noise in the background.
Well, and I've been to places that sell sandwiches, and, you know, there's a big sign that says, if you get a sugary beverage, you're going to pay 89 more cents or something like that. I mean, it's...
No one's going to die of thirst in Philadelphia. if that's what you want, then, you know, folks are going to pay for it. You know, there are other products. The soda people make water. Again, when you look at what it's for, you know, if we think longer term, there will be enormous benefit, not only on the health side, but also on the services and universal pre-K and all these other kinds of issues. I think that we have to stay focused on what is the current business environment. Do we have a workforce? Is there land? Are there buildings? And how we position the city of Philadelphia, not only in the region, but really across the United States and around the world. And I think we really need to stay focused on those issues.
Go ahead, Josh, and then we'll get some callers into the conversation.
Yeah. I think what's a bit more concerning is when you what happened was a narrative started to emerge from some voices within the business community when they looked at the totality of several ordinances and they started to say – these ordinances are starting to have a negative impact on job growth, or it starts to seem like we have a city government that's trying to tell companies how to do their business. I think the issue is if a narrative like that starts to take root, then that's when you start having some bigger impact. We had a negative business narrative like that around the wage tax was very loud 15 years ago. I'm a little concerned to make sure that the kind of the seedling of this narrative doesn't grow any further. I think that would have some lasting impact. And that's really, I think, something for business community and government to really have a bit more conversation on the right balance. Yeah.
And it's about message and you know, what else is going on across the country. As Josh said, any one of these things singularly is probably not what drives a person to say, you know, I just can't take it anymore. But if it's a series of things, fairly rapid succession, you know, theoretically, you know, someone saying, well, today they're doing this, and then next week they're doing that, and then the other week, and, you know, it's just too much. And often is that one last thing, but it's not the only thing. It was the totality of a series of things over time. And we have to try to maintain some level of control over that narrative, but also give a perspective of what else is going on in the rest of the country. Often we are not the only folks who are doing some of these things. This is a progressive city. Has a different kind of demographic with a different kind of economy. We need to make sure that when you put it all together in an effort to do good, that we're not experiencing some unintended consequences that lead to some negative outcome.
Let me get Jean from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Jean, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. We'll get Jean. Go ahead. Whoops. Go ahead, Jean. Well, okay. We will we'll figure out how to get Jean on the air. A comment from Nancy. She says, I've noticed that when a store closes, the location stays empty for a very long time. Is this a problem with licenses and inspections? I don't know if either of you can answer that, but I'll just sort of leave it out there.
It could be a function of, you know, what's going on with the building owner, landlord. You know, what do they want in the space? How are they managing, you know, is this the only place they have, or is it, you know, they have, is it a, you know, you look at a place like, you know, Manayunk or Northern Liberties, or, you know, you can have property owners who own multiple properties who are then trying to figure out what's the right mix or something like that. So, I mean, it's kind of case specific.
Yeah, also, I know for myself, I try to do as much shopping on Amazon in order to save time for the other things in life.
And yeah, but look, then you're putting these little mom-and-pop stores.
Not the intention, but again, yes. You know, I think everyone can say that individually, but there's a reality why Amazon has gotten so large. These are broader trends in the economy. It's a highly competitive, convenient service. So there are broader trends around retail and for the retail that is remaining, where it locates, where it clusters.
Again, this goes back to, you know, a serious discussion. And it's not just a local discussion. It really is a national discussion. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, not to beat the drum too loudly, I mean, cities will continue to struggle dealing with issues of poverty and inequality without a federal government that is a true partner. But, you know, look at what's going on with the research around autonomous vehicles, right? So where is the discussion with, for instance, the trucking community or the car community that, I mean, unfortunately, it seems like a bunch of folks may lose their jobs if vehicles are moving without drivers. Well, what are those folks going to do? And who's having a discussion about retraining or, you know, I mean, not everyone's going to go into computers, but, I mean, somebody's got to manage what's going on with that operation. So, I mean, when someone walks up to you and says, you know, you no longer have a job, I mean, that's not the moment to start thinking about retraining.
Hmm. Yeah.
A very fast-changing economy. Mm-hmm. Josh, let me go back to you. And just I just found this so interesting, and I hadn't thought about it, the fact that from your organization, the Economy League, that we don't have enough rich people. Did I read that right?
Well, this was.
Well, I would be one of them. So.
I mean, really rich people.
It's kind of the point was really just around what's the base of wealth, and really, in some ways, this is about our ability to tax to provide public goods. And so, just if you look at compared to other cities, a smaller concentration in the city. So, again, if you have a less wealthy or poorer overall base. This can lead to kind of some vicious cycles. So it certainly isn't about wealthy people themselves not getting into that at all. Right. It's really about ratables. It's really about tax base to be able to make the kinds of investments we need to move the city's residents forward and to get on a higher growth trajectory.
Let me try Gene again. Sure. Gene calling us from Philadelphia. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
We have the majority of people in Philadelphia, 18 to 20 years old, have a 12th grade education or less. And I don't think you can see any long-term growth unless that issue is addressed. I mean, from the coal fields to the rust belts, there is a huge part of the population that are not going to go to medical school or become database programmers. And specialists have talked about this, economists, of where is our society going to be 20 years from now if automation takes away these jobs? Is the Economy League, is Penn or the academic community or the Chamber of Commerce addressing that issue?
Because, well, we kind of touched on that a little bit earlier, Gene.
I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago.
Okay, well, that's okay.
Well, I think one thing to note is you need to, as rapidly as the economy changes, understand the changing nature of this work. And in the Economy League's recent look at our tech workforce, we see that one-third of current IT positions in the region require less than a bachelor's degree. So again, changing that perspective for people to understand. If you are coming out of high school, maybe with one extra course at a community college, you can get tracked onto a really solid family-sustaining wage path, but for people to understand that's available to them in these IT jobs that are at tech firms and at non-tech firms across the region.
Marty, I just showed Josh this an hour and a half ago. LinkedIn sent me a note that says, explore job openings in greater Philadelphia area. More than 72,000 new jobs are available now, with a picture of Philadelphia shot clearly from the art museum, and you know, a bunch of companies. So I don't know where these companies are. I'm not trying to promote them. They may be in the city. They may be in the region. So again, getting that information out to let folks know, and you know, I understand where the caller is coming from.
Sure.
But you actually don't know someone's potential until they have an opportunity to demonstrate what that potential is. And we should not think of folks, you know, in whatever way, just because they weren't doing what they could be doing 6 months or a year from now.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Michael Nutter, nice to have you back with us on Radio
Always
Times.
Good, Marty.
Josh Seven, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. My thanks to Mary Cummings Jordan for filling in for me last week. Also to the Radio Times producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoen. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.